4. The horror came for the commandant again that night, in the grey area that was the half-light from a full moon. It was worse this time. In the dream, he rose from his camp bed in the pale light of dawn. Down the valley, the chimneys above the charnel wagons belched dark smoke. Nothing else in the camp was moving. He walked between the silent tents and under the guard towers to the funicular, which took him up through the forests to the glaciers. The light was blinding white, and the cold thin air rasped the back of his throat. The wind buffeted him, raising veils of snow and ice that shifted across the fractured surfaces of the great river of ice, contained between the jagged banks of rock black and snow-white mountains. The commandant looked around. They were quarrying the deep western face now. It was the first time he'd seen this latest sight. The face itself lay inside a great bowl they'd blasted in the glacier. Men, machines, and drag lines moved like insects in the bottom of the vast cup of shining ice. The face was pure white, except for a speckling of black dots, which from this distance appeared just like boulders. It looked dangerously steep, he thought, but cutting it at a shallower angle would have taken longer, and they were forever being hurried along by headquarters. At the top of the inclined ramp, where the draglines released their hooked cargoes, a train waited, smoke drifting blackly across a blindingly white landscape. Guards stamped their feet, engineers stood in animated discussion by the winch engine, and a caravan shack disgorged another shift of stackers fresh from a break. A sledge full of face workers was being lowered down the huge gash in the ice. He could make out the sullen, pinched faces of the men, bundled in uniforms and clothes that were little better than rags. There was a rumble and a vibration beneath his feet. He looked round to the ice face again, to see the entire eastern half of it crumbling away, collapsing and falling with majestic slowness in billowing clouds of whiteness onto the tiny black dots of the workers and guards below. He watched the little figures turn and run from the rushing avalanche of ice as it pressed down through the air and along the surface towards them. A few made it, most did not, disappearing under the huge white wave, rubbed out amongst that chalky, glittering turmoil. The noise was a roar so deep he felt it in his chest. He ran along the lip of the face cut to the top of the inclined plane. Everybody was shouting and running around. The entire bottom of the bowl was filling with white mist of the kicked-up snow and pulverized ice, obscuring the still-running survivors, just as the icefall itself had those it had buried. The winch engine labored, making a high screeching noise. The drag lines had stopped. He ran on to the knots of people gathering near the inclined plane. "I know what happens here," he thought. "I know what happens to me. I remember the pain. I see the girl. I know this bit. I know what happens. I must stop running. Why don't I stop running? Why can't I stop? Why can't I wake up?" As he got to the others, the strain on the trap drag line, still being pulled by the winch engine, proved too much. The steel hawser parted somewhere down inside the bowl of mist with a noise like a shot. The steel cable came hissing and sizzing up through the air, snaking and wriggling as it ripped up the slope towards the lip, loosing most of its grisly cargo from its hooks as it came, like drops of ice off a whip. He screamed to the men at the top of the inclined plane, and tripped, falling onto his face in the snow. Only one of the engineers dropped in time. Most of the rest were cut neatly in half by the scything hawser, falling slowly to the snow in bloody sprays. Loops of the hawser smacked off the railway engine with a thunderous clanging noise, and wrapped themselves around the winch housing as though with relief. Other coils thumped heavily to the snow. Something hit his upper leg with the force of a fully swung sledgehammer, breaking his bones in a cataclysm of pain. The impact rolled him over and over in the snow, while the bones ground and dug and pissed. It went on for what felt like half a day. He came to rest in the snow, screaming. He was face to face with the thing that had hit him. It was one of the bodies the dragline had flicked off as it tore up the slope. Another corpse they'd hacked and loosened and pulled like a rotten tooth from the new face of the glacier that morning. A dead witness that it was their duty to discover and remove with all dispatch and secrecy to the charnel wagons in the valley below, to be turned from an accusatory body to innocent smoke and ash. What had hit him and shattered his leg was one of the bodies which had been dumped in the glacier half a generation ago, when the enemies of the race had been expunged from the newly conquered territories. The scream forced its way from his lungs like something desperate to be borne to the freezing air, like something aching to join the screams he could hear spread around him near the lip of the inclined plane. The commandant's breath was gone. He stared into the rock-hard face of the body that had hit him, and he sobbed for breath to scream again. It was a child's face, a girl's. The snow burnt his face. His breath would not come back. His leg was a burning brand of pain lighting up his whole body. But not his eyes. The view began to dim. "Why is this happening to me? Why won't it stop? Why can't I stop it? Why can't I wake up? What makes me relive these terrible memories?" Then the pain and the cold went away, seemed to be taken away, and another kind of coldness came upon him. And he found himself thinking about all that had happened, reviewing, judging. "In the deserts, we burned them immediately. None of this sloppiness. Was it some attempt at poetry to bury them in the glacier? Interred where they were so far up the ice sheet, their bodies would stay in the ice for centuries, buried too deep for anyone to find without the killing effort we had to put into it. Did our leaders begin to believe their own propaganda, that their rule would last 100 lifetimes, and so started to think that far ahead? Could they see the melt lakes below the glacier's ragged, dirty skirt all those centuries from now, covered with the floating bodies released from the ice's grip? Did it start to worry them what people would think of them then? In the deserts, we burned them immediately. They came out in the long trains, through the burning heat and the choking dust. And the ones that hadn't died in the black trucks, we offered copious water. No will could resist the thirst those baking days spent amongst death had built up in them. They drank the poisoned water and died within hours. We incinerated the plundered bodies in solar furnaces, our offering to the insatiable sky gods of race and purity. And there seemed to be something pure about the way they were disposed of, as though their deaths gave them a nobility they could never have achieved in their mean, degraded lives. Their ashes fell like a lighter dust on the powderous emptiness of the desert, to be blown away together in the first storm. The last furnace loads were the camp workers, gassed in their dormitories mostly. And all the paperwork, every letter, every order, every requisition pad, store sheet, file, note, and memo. We were all searched, even I. Those the special police found hiding diaries were shot on the spot. Most of our effects went up in smoke, too. What we were allowed to keep had been searched so thoroughly, we joked they'd managed to remove each grain of sand from our uniforms, something the laundry had never been able to do. We were split up and moved to different posts throughout the conquered territories. Reunions were not encouraged. I thought of writing down what had happened, not to confess, but to explain. And we suffered too, not just in the physical conditions, though those were bad enough, but in our minds, in our consciences. There may have been a few brutes, a few monsters who gloried in it all. Perhaps we kept a few murderers off the streets of our cities for all that time. But most of us went through intermittent agonies, wondering in moments of crisis if what we were doing was really right, even though in our hearts we knew it was. So many of us had nightmares, the things we saw each day, the scenes we witnessed, the pain and the terror. These things could not help but affect us. Those we disposed of, their torment lasted a few days, maybe a month or two. Then it was over as quickly and efficiently as we could make the process. Our suffering has gone on for a generation. I am proud of what I did. I wish it had not fallen to me to do what had to be done, but I'm glad that I did it to the best of my capabilities, and I would do it again. That was why I wanted to write down what had happened. To witness our belief and our dedication and our suffering. I never did. I am proud of that, too. He awoke, and there was something inside his head. He was back in reality, back in the present, back in the bedroom of his house in the retirement complex near the sea. He could see the sunlight hitting the tiles of the balcony outside the room. His twin hearts thumped. The scales had risen on his back, prickling him. His leg ached, echoing with the pain of that ancient injury on the glacier. The dream had been the most vivid yet, and the longest, finally taking him to the icefall in the western face and the accident with the dragline. Deep buried that had been in his memory, submerged beneath all the dread white weight of his remembered pain. As well as that, whatever he had experienced had gone beyond the normal course, the usual environment of dreams, propelled there by the reliving of the accident and the image of fighting for breath while he stared transfixed into the face of the dead girl. He'd found himself thinking, explaining, even justifying what he'd done in his army career. In the most definitive part of his life. And now he could feel something inside his head. Whatever it was inside his head got him to close his eyes. "At last," it said. It was a deep, deliberately authoritative voice, its pronunciation almost too perfect. At last, he thought, what was this? I have the truth. What truth? Who was this? Of what you did, your people, what? The evidence was everywhere. Across the desert, caked in loam, lodged in plants, sunk to the bottom of lakes, and there, in the cultural record, too, the sudden vanishings of artworks, changes in architecture and agriculture. There were a few hidden records, books, photographs, sound recordings, indices, which contradicted the rewritten histories. But they still didn't directly explain why so many people, so many peoples, seemed to vanish so suddenly without any sign of assimilation. What are you talking about? What was this in his head? You would not believe what I am, Commandant. But what I am talking about is a thing called genocide, and the proof thereof. We did what had to be done, thank you. We've just been through all that. Your self-justifications have been noted. I believed in what I did, I know. You had the residual decency to question it occasionally, but in the end you did indeed believe in what you were doing. That is not an excuse, but it is a point. Who are you? What gives you the right to crawl inside my brains? My name would be something like grey area in your language. What gives me the right to crawl inside your brains, as you put it, is the same thing that gave you the right to do what you did to those you murdered. Power. Superior power. Vastly superior power in my case. However, I've been called away, and I have to leave you now. But I shall return in a few months, and I'll be continuing my investigations then. There are still enough of you left to construct a more triangulated case. What? He thought, trying to open his eyes. Commandant! There is nothing worse I can wish upon you than to be what you already are. But you might care to reflect upon this while I'm gone. Instantly he was back in the dream. He fell through the bed. The single ice-white sheet tore beneath him and tumbled him into a bottomless tank of blood. He fell down through it to light and the desert and the rail line through the sands. He fell into one of the trains, into one of the trucks, and was there with his broken leg amongst the stinking dead and the moaning living, jammed in between the excrement-covered bodies with the weeping sores and the buzz of flies and the white-hot rage of the thirst inside him. He died in the cattle truck, after an infinity of agony. There was time for the briefest of glimpses of his room in the retirement complex. Even in his still-shocked, pain-maddened state, he had the time and the presence of mind to think that while it felt as though a day at least must have passed while he'd been submerged in the torture dream, nevertheless, everything in the bedroom looked just as it had earlier. Then he was dragged under again. He awoke entombed inside the glacier, dying of cold. He'd been shot in the head, but it had only paralyzed him. Another endless agony. He had a second impression of the retirement home. Still, the sunlight was at the same angle. had not imagined it was possible to feel so much pain, not in such a time, not in a lifetime, not in 100 lifetimes. He found there was just time to flex his body and move a finger's width across the bed before the dream resumed. Then he was in the hold of a ship, crammed in with thousands of other people in the darkness, surrounded again by stink and filth and screams and pain. He was already half dead 2 days later when the sea valves opened and those still left alive began to drown. The cleaner found the old retired commandant twisted into a ball a little way short of the apartment's door the next morning. His hearts had given out. The expression on his face was such that the retirement home warden almost fainted and had to sit down quickly. But the doctor declared the end had probably been quick.